Thank you.
Yesterday.
Okay, so before I go into the actual topic, maybe let me just start with a discussion of a couple of things that were raised during this week. The first one being the power law integrated sensitivity, which is something that I mentioned yesterday. Essentially, also just to let you know what sensitivity curves you'll be looking at for most of this talk. So the problem here is typically that experiments tend to give you, say, the strain sensitivity SH as what they can measure. But the sensitivity that we show is quite different, and this is, well, firstly, because we need to convert to the abundance of gravitational waves, which is way more convenient if you're talking about a stochastic background. But you see that already introduces an F2 power 3. So actually, for this example, in this plot, I chose SH, which was just constant, with the support over all of this frequency range. And then the detector sensitivity we end up with is already a power law. And this is the sort of instantaneous sensitivity. So whenever a short-lasting event would have an abundance above that, we would see it with significant signal-to-noise. But actually, stochastic backgrounds that we can integrate over time don't need to be above that curve to be observable. And in practice, what we need to look for is the signal-to-noise, which is, as you see, an integral over the signal over the noise, but times the time of integration that we have. And this is typically of order of a few years, so it does improve quite a bit. Now, of course, the problem is it's difficult to visualize because you don't have a signal to begin with, typically, if you just want to show the sensitivity. So one method to do it that people came up with is the power law integrated sensitivity. With essentially, what you do then is... Just when I needed it.
It'll come back. You have to let it cool. And
it'll come back. It'll come back. Okay.
Well, you have to turn it back on after it cools.
Not so clear why I turned it off, though, because the screen is still on.
My screen is working.
No, I thought you hit it on the button to turn it off.
I tried that, but...
Well, but that looks...
Just a quicker.
You need to lubricate it.
But how? This seems to be working. No.
That's where your screen is.
It is larger, for sure.
It seems to be doing something, but maybe I'll use a different cable, I don't know.
Well, the projector sounds like a countdown.
Yeah.
Oh, the projectors.
Who's the...
Actually, I have a question for you. So, if you look at this in, say, a radio astronomy point of view, the CMB, the difference between detecting a source which is either spatially variable or temporally variable is very different than having a stochastic source of noise that you cannot modulate. So knowing what the signal-to-noise ratio is depends on knowing the noise of the instrument to a level that you can say there's something additional here stochastically, which is not varying with time, not varying spatially, and therefore it's a very, very different problem than, say, detecting in spiraling black holes, which are temporally variable. And
that is
a very, very difficult thing experimentally to differentiate. The CMB is a good example. Without the ability to block the incoming photons, modulate, unblock, block, you would not know that there is a signal there.
Sure. So it's also complicated in gravitational wave experiments, but people do come up with methods of how to do it. Essentially, for LISA, for example, I think there is a channel which is largely insensitive to the actual signal, but you can still read it off, and that tells you what the noise is, and this allows you to sort of integrate over time. And that's actually what's improving the sensitivity. And for instance, LIGO is also doing that, but just correlating two detectors, which have different noise. Yes, but essentially, I optimistically assume it's doable in every one of those detectors. Okay, but then what we do to visually show the sensitivity is just to draw all the possible power laws, which are these black lines that you see here. That would give us a desired signal-to-noise ratio. So here I chose 10 as an example. The time is 5 years, which is sort of quite typical for gravitational wave experiments. And then you just take the overlay of all of those curves, this is, and call it the power law integrated sensitivity. And by construction, you see that, well, the feature this curve has is that if a power law signal just touches it, the signal-to-noise ratio will be 10. If you're thinking of a signal which is not a power law, it will be a bit different, but still this is a simple way to show roughly what the sensitivity can be. Okay, and now it's motivation. This is the experimental outlook that we're looking at in the near future. So currently we only have PTA experiments. This is, for instance, the EPTA. All of them are quite similar in sensitivity, I would say. And we also, of course, have LIGO. In fact, quite a bit less of LIGO, because this is the design sensitivity that they will get to integrating over time. But in relatively near future, this is all of those colorful lines is what we will see, most notably, of course, with LISA, which in 2034, or even earlier, will start probing all of this green area of the parameter space. There's, of course, also SKA, which is currently being built, and over the whole long planned observational campaign, it will increase its sensitivity, and after 20 years, also reach a very good sensitivity compared to current experiments. There are also, of course, third generation terrestrial gravitational wave experiments. So Einstein telescope is one example here, sort of a successor to LIGO. Another experiment quite similar to this would be the Cosmic Explorer. I didn't have a curve for that one to put on the plot here. And then the third branch would be atom interferometry-based experiments, notably the MAGIS ION proposal. I was a bit rude here and I just called it ION, but MAGIS curves, sensitivity curves, are also the same. And actually, you still need both to measure the stochastic background anyway, probably. Yes, so this is the sensitivity that ION would reach in its 100-meter incarnation, which, if funded, which we hope will happen soon, could be built in a couple of years. And then, of course, by 2030, the goal would be to have a kilometer version, which would could probe this purple part of the parameter space. And then finally, there is the satellite version, EDGE, that we actually proposed to ESA for the Voyage 2050 call. So hopefully, by 2050, we'll also be probing the blue area here. Okay, so with this, now we see why we're doing it.
Yes.
So GGN, this is an experimental problem. This is gravitational gradient noise. But we don't really use that constraint, because the problem with that is that it's only coming from one measurement. Essentially, the problem is that even though the atoms are in freefall, they are still on the ground. So when the Earth is shaking, it gravitationally it changes the gravitational potential. So it also introduces a source of noise. But this is not a very good estimate, because this is only based on one measurement that someone did in a mine somewhere once. And there was no attempt to try and help this in any way. But this is the sort of most pessimistic sensitivity that you could reach if it turns out that for some reason this is an insurmountable problem.
It should be, right? Because it's just the Earth vibrating in a second. Is there a way to get around that?
I would think so, yes. I mean, LIGO and Virgo are doing it. They just have a bunch of seismometers that measure and try to...
They're attached to things, right? This is, the atoms are in free fall, so you would, how do you shield gravitational fields in free fall?
That's not up to me. I did not design the experiment, but... But if you ask MAGIS and ION people, they're more optimistic than this GGN. But just for honesty, that they show it. This is the least optimistic that you can think of. There are actually quite a few atom interferometry experiments that are working on this. So I'm sure there will be progress in the next couple of years. Okay.
Mark, sorry, how realistic do you consider some of these curves, like IH or AOM? Because, you know, like the LISA case, I think it's very well-funded because there was LISA Pathfinder, which demonstrated that the noise even performs better than it's required for the actual LISA mission. But what about these other experiments, you know? Is it, this is the most favorable case that you are showing there, the most optimistic case, or is really robust there?
Well, that's a difficult question, right? That's why there is a whole campaign of trying to improve over time rather than just one thing and saying we'll do this in 10 years. It's an ongoing program. And so the first prototypes that are being built are actually probably somewhere here, the 10-meter version.
If you want, what I'm asking you, like before the LISA noise was fixed to the actual curve we have, if you remember, there was a dispersion of curves. So for these other experiments, are you showing the most optimistic case, or is really a dispersion of the sensitivities which could make it much worse?
So this depends on how well, how much you can improve the cold atom technology. So the answer is, I don't know. I was told those are reasonable parameters. But if they can actually reach that by 2050, well, we'll see with the kilometer version, for instance. Okay. So this is the optimistic.
The general thing, the reason we are putting that just to fill up the gap is that because there's no, the size, I mean, for atom interferometry, you could make the frequency based on the length of the type of flight and so on. So the reason it's chosen in this region is just to fill the gap between LISA and LIGO. Is that why it's chosen? Is there some other technical consideration why it's chosen there?
I'm not exactly sure. I mean, you can probably change it a bit, but I'm sure there are limits. Except they are coming from the cold atom part of the story, which I'm not that fluent in. Okay, but also this is the, from all the possibilities, this is pretty good because it is filling the gap between LISA and ET. Okay, so now on to the actual topic.
The frequency of the best sensitivity for the atomic ion, the atomic atom interferometry, though, is all about the same. I wonder, and yet the baselines are quite different. So it's not just a time of flight issue here.
Yes, that's why I'm saying it's based on the atom source more than the actual arm length.
I mean, how would you compare it to the radio case, the SKA case, which you're really probing a very different, it's probably a very different space for SKA.
It is, yes. Oh, but SKA is a very, very different experiment.
Yeah, no, totally different. Yeah, that's my question, is how would you compare in terms of going after the primordial gravitational wave background?
You mean in its potential for discovery? Also, I will be talking about that a whole lot in the talk, okay. So you'll see. Actually, for cosmic strings, SKA is typically a pretty good candidate if the string tension is large enough. But we'll get there. Yes. But before we get there, let's... let's move to the blackboard part. Which one is this? Oh, yeah, that's the okay. Afterwards, yes. Maybe if I.
Okay.
Okay, so now on to cosmic strings. There was a talk last week about cosmic strings, but maybe let me start with a very basic introduction. So essentially, what are cosmic strings? And to try and explain it, I will use the, by far the simplest model that I know, which produces cosmic strings, which would be just a well, we add a scalar, charges under a U1 symmetry, and the symmetry breaks at some point. So the potential we're thinking of is a typical Mexican hat potential. As I said, at some point, not very symmetric, the symmetry breaks, and essentially the field rolls down into the minimum, and it chooses the direction in which it rolls randomly. Of course, it doesn't matter for local physics, as you know. But the global solution can depend on it quite a lot, and that's because if we have disconnected regions that do it sort of independently, if I draw arrows to show you which way the field went, and we do something like this, you'll see you'll encounter a problem in this point here. And this would, of course, correspond to a cosmic string coming out of the blackboard, because the field cannot resolve this jump in the face here. So instead, at this point, it just stays at the original, well, now maximum in the potential. Okay, and of course, typically those areas would be, if it was a second order transition, it would be just the Hubble. The disconnected horizons in a first order phase transitions, those would be bubbles that nucleate of the different two vacua as the symmetry breaks. Okay, but essentially, this is the simple version of the story. Of course, if you do this in three dimensions, what you end up with is a complicated network of these one-dimensional objects that is produced at some point as the symmetry breaks. So maybe let me just give you a few very simple and rather intuitive features that we will need later on. So firstly, tell you, we'll sort of divide the network into either infinite strings that actually stretch beyond the horizon and just go out somewhere. This is rho infinite, and also loops that are closed loops of the string. So first let's think about just the infinite strings. You won't be surprised when I tell you that, of course, if there were no interactions or interesting dynamics, this would just go as a to power minus 2. If it wasn't very, very relativistic, it's just like matter, but with one more spatial dimension. But thankfully, so this would, of course, be a problem, because, as you know, topological defects tend to, if the density grows this quickly, it would tend to dominate the expansion of the universe. But for cosmic strings, the interesting dynamics thankfully help with that. And this is because there is another mechanism for energy loss, which is that if two strings collide, or like this, they will actually intersect and will end up with less infinite strings and a loop. So this is a mechanism of energy loss, and thanks to that, what happens is this modulate this growth, and in practice, in the end, we reach a scaling solution in which rho infinite over rho total is just proportional to a constant, g mu. Okay, so g mu is the key parameter that we will use in describing all of those networks. So this is a phenomenological parameter that can be in any kind of cosmic string network, including the ones from string theory, you can define it. But for us, in this very simple case, so this is of course the Newton constant times the energy per unit length, and in our very simple case, this would be just proportional in the simplest approximation, well, very roughly, to the VEV of the field over the Planck mass squared. So this tells you roughly about the energy scale of the problems that we'll be dealing with. And as you'll see, well, the scale needs to be rather high, of order of 10 to the 10 GeV, not 100 GeV. Of course, 100 GeV symmetry breaking would also produce cosmic strings, but the signal would be far too weak to be observed in gravitational wave experiments. Okay. So this is the one key parameter that we'll keep on using. The other one is the size of the loop. So if we're thinking in terms of the one-scale model, which assumes that we can just use one scale to describe the string network, we would say that loops are typically born in this process with a given length. And people used to call this conventionally alpha, and typically this is just proportional. I mean, this multiplied by time, this is the initial length of the loop. So now the value of this was a source of a big discussion back in the day, but thankfully over the last couple of years, all of the simulations done recently converged, and the value here seems to just be 0.1. So this is, there's one simplification that we can do, and we will actually use this value throughout the talk.
Sorry, I didn't quite understand. This is the length of the loop at a given time.
This is length of the loops as they are produced. We will assume all of the loops are produced the same and with this length. Which sounds a bit odd, but actually numerical simulations of those cosmic string networks support this. So you can actually describe the results pretty well using just this very simple approximation. Okay, so this is the length of the loop. And then, of course, the question is what happens with the loops themselves. For now, we just assume the energy goes away and this gives us scaling. But actually what happens is there's a lot of energy contained in the loops. So they just they start to oscillate and emit gravitational waves. Eventually, they disappear altogether. And this, of course, brings us to the signals that we'll be thinking of. So gravitational wave spectra produced by cosmic strings.
So I think something we were discussing earlier as well. So I wanted to get a sense, when these loops are produced and they evolve, is there a sense in which there is an understanding of the scale of fluctuations on a loop as a function of length on the loop? Meaning, are there wiggles on the loop? And what is the typical size of the wiggles? And what is the sort of power spectrum of those sizes on the loop? Is there an understanding of what that is?
I'm not exactly sure. So it's true, we'll run into this problem later on, actually. Typically what people do is they try to not care, in the sense that what I was about to say is that one method that people most often use to calculate the gravitational wave spectrum is just to assume that there's some total power radiated by the loop. If we call it gamma, then this would be, the length will be just Ti minus gamma g mu t minus ti, such that we radiate, and then this power is numerically, people kept evolving those loops, and they saw that this power, if you put the value 50, it actually matches quite well how quickly the loops disappear. So this is, this is one way to go around it. We'll see the other way, which is quite to the contrary, to assume that there are features that radiate away all of this energy. Because in this approximation, you would think the loop just has its oscillation modes and radiates and disappears. You don't really care how it happens. But in practice, it's true that it has features. It can have a kink, which will produce gravitational waves, or a cusp. And those things would be, you know, beaming gravitational waves in a given direction, which is quite a different signal. But yes, what I'm going to say is that there is no very clear understanding of this, I'm afraid. So people didn't really, as far as I know at least.
So I'm not sure why you are saying that. I mean, so people have studied what is the gravitational wave emission within a given solid angle from these features. And this 50 comes from the average over many loops who have these features. And then it's just a way of substituting the statistics of the system by saying, at the end of the day, a typical loop with one king, one cat, emits this in this rate of energy density, you know, in practice.
I agree.
People have worked out analytically very well what is the emission of each feature.
Of course. No, but what I'm saying is that I don't think this was analyzed know, scrutinized too much, because you can either do this, or in the other method you assume there is a n cusps or n kinks, right? And then you fix the number such that gamma is actually 50. So you assume that there is a couple of features and they radiate such that you get this power. But I don't think anyone actually did a detailed analysis of how many of them there can be.
But 50 couplings measured, calibrated in simulations of this number, what the simulations you were referring to, that is the 0.1, they obtain 50. There is a distribution, okay, and the mean value is 50.
Okay.
So this is really measured in simulation. It was also analytically computed originally based on having one kink, one cusp per loop, but this is what these people of number were the simulations here.
Okay. And then at least, so I have to admit, I don't know what the distribution is, but for computational purposes, you can either do the average, 50, or just assume there is one. Or actually, the value is 2.1 cusp, I think, per loop, and that would give you the 50. And this is what we will use to calculate the gravitational wave signals. Okay. So now that we know this, on to the actual signal. So of course what we are interested in is omega, which is just 8 pi g over 3 a0 squared f d rho df. And as I said, there are at least two methods of calculating this. We'll start with method one, which is the averaged out power using this value of 50. And then the formula that we would be using is, well, there's some pre-factor, which is not that interesting. So we, of course, integrate over time from zero up until today. So throughout the history of the universe, there's appropriate redshift factors. Then we integrate over the whole population of loops, dl, l, and there is this very problematic loop number density. But finally, we say that power is just it's only a one variable problem. So it doesn't depend on l and t, it's just the average power depending on the overall scale of the loop and the frequency that we're interested in. Okay, so I won't actually dwell too much on this formula. I don't think it's very enlightening to actually write down exactly how this expression would look like when you're integrating it, but let me just point out that this is what's causing a bit of a problem in the community these days. This is the number density of loops. So you would think that if you can do a simulation of this, you can count the loops, you know how many of them are there, and you just know this as a function of time, which is true, but it's not the whole truth. So what we will use is the velocity-dependent one-scale model, which is a very nice analytical model. It's just a slight modification of the one-scale model that I very briefly talked about. But essentially, it's very useful because it allows you to compute n. You just solve differential equations, and that allows you to calculate n. Of course, the only validation such a phenomenological model can have is to fit it to actual simulations that try and capture this. But it turns out that the result that you get is pretty good. You just need to multiply it by a Fudge factor to make them match perfectly. But this is only true if you're thinking about the simulations done by Ken Olum and José Juan Blanco Pilado. There is also another group, Mary Seclariadu, Christophe Rangeval, and others, who came up with a different number density, essentially because they did a very involved analytical modeling on top of what they saw in the simulation. At least as far as I understand it. And that model is very different because then they have a huge population of very small loops, which changes everything that I was going to talk about. So instead, we will just focus on the Voss model, which is validated by one of the simulations, and stay in this relatively simple and predictable scenario.
You said you have to multiply by some number to match?
Yes. So actually the reason behind it is, so the VOS model allows you to calculate this, but the result that you get is typically just 10 times too big. So you multiply by another factor of 0.1. And the reason for that is, in the simulations, they see that quite a lot of small loops are produced with very high velocities that then just redshift away, and that energy is essentially lost. While all of the gravitational wave power is actually produced by the largest loops, and roughly 10% of the energy goes into those large loops. So this is something that the one-scale model cannot capture, but if you just multiply by 0.1, the results match very well. So in that sense, you can save the model and still use it in agreement with simulations.
So what I don't understand, so it doesn't get the analytic form of that function, correct? It doesn't get any characteristic?
It does get the analytical form of the function perfectly, but there is just a value multiplying the whole thing.
But just now you were saying it doesn't correctly predict the number of small loops, for example.
No.
Okay. You're saying it's dominated by the gravitational wave emission, is dominated by large loops, and then it can rescale to match that. No. I mean, can you repeat again so I understand what it does and doesn't?
Okay, sorry. So there are two things. First, there is one simulation, which, as I say, agrees with this model just up to this 0.1 factor. Those huge numbers of very small loops are predicted in a very different analytical modeling that introduces an extra scale and actually, well, in the end makes things a whole lot more complicated. In the simple version, maybe actually you're right. In the sense that 10% of the loops goes into those very large loops that then radiate gravitational waves, but a lot of the energy goes into small but very fast loops that then just lose energy by redshifting. But the point is that the function that you get, if you just use it in this expression, matches very well with what you would get in the actual simulation. So,
which quantity? For the gravitational waves?
Yes.
But okay, that could be just because it's dominated by the largest ones and you're scaling them to whatever you need to reproduce it. I haven't yet understood what it does and doesn't predict for the beginning one. Because now you again said it's similar to where you, I guess you don't care about this model, so it doesn't matter whether it predicts those.
Well, I do care, but no. The point is that if you were trying to do this in the one-scale model without, there is essentially always a multiplicative factor that you need to fit to something. In the VOS model, you fix it with modeling, but the resulting multiplicative factor doesn't come out exactly right, and you need this 0.1 to make sure that it works. But given that we're talking about gravitational wave signals, I am pretty sure that just using this gives you the correct answer. This is in fact how the people doing the simulation interpreted their results. They said that everything is fine in the one-scale model if you just include this, and they then explained where the rest of the energy disappears into.
You were saying that the small loops are very energetic, so the contribution to the
future. Yeah, I don't understand, but that thing doesn't tell me whether this function correctly predicts. I mean, there is a quantity that I should be able to measure in the simulations, which is just the number of loops as a function of size at a given time. That's just a well-defined physical quantity. So then I can ask whether this model reproduces that or not. Then the second question is whether I actually need that physical quantity to predict the gravitational waves. And the answer seems to be no, because I don't care about this model.
So this formula here, why doesn't the power radiated depend on the loop length?
Why does it?
The last factor is, what is the last factor?
I think it has elements.
This is L.
Oh, that's
L.
TL.
Oh,
yeah. TL. Oh, okay. All right. Okay. So then why does that not account for it then? Why is that not just a steep decline?
What doesn't account for it?
I'm just confused.
I'm trying to parse this equation, and I think I missed some. So you're integrating over all, that's a dl?
Yes, that, and this is a dl times l.
dl times l.
There is an extra l in the formula.
Okay. And I'm sorry, this is probably really trivial, but I'm not following your definition of omega. You're adding the rate of change of?
No, this is f. This is also f. I could just write d log f here. Okay.
Sorry.
Ah, yes, my perfect handwriting. This is g.
Okay.
G
mu squared.
And so that's an f. You're logging, that's an f, not a t.
Hmm? G mu squared?
Yes.
Wait, what about it? That's not.
No, it's genius. Does the mu look like
n? What? Okay. Now it looks like a mu. Okay.
And then the rho dt, and then you have a time integral there.
This is f.
Log.
So the integral is t or f?
No, the integral is t.
Okay, your f and t.
That t and that f are identical.
I can sometimes tell them apart. Okay.
Before you move on, sorry. Yes, there's another one. So the people that do the complicated simulation where you get many small loops, they also have a predict the emission of gravitational waves, right?
That's true, you can...
That, I guess, disagrees with this Bose model.
It disagrees.
Yeah, but it's not they do more complicated simulation. It's the way they extract information from their simulation, which is based on an analytical model that lets them introduce extra scales, and the result is the fitting formula for loop number density is different because predicts a different population of loops at the smaller scales, which these other simulations don't see. Okay, so it's the loop number density that they obtain differently from the way they extract the simulation from the information from the simulation.
But you could take the simulations and do the same extraction procedure.
We've been asking them to do that for a long while. Yes.
Well, no, but the problem is that there is a very specific form that's actually integrable, and you get it in the one scale model. But if you choose a power differently, you always get a divergent function. And when you try to measure the power, how this falls down when you go to smaller loops, you always get an error on it, right? So it's, well, the value is 2.5 in the one-scale model, but what you get from a simulation trying to just fit a curve to that is always 2.5 plus minus something. So, and in practice, the value, if I understand it correctly, the value that would give you an integrable function was within that error, but they just chose the central value instead, which was slightly higher, such that you get a huge population of small loops. And so then they did all this analytical modeling, because of course it's a divergent function, you need an extra cutoff that you have to introduce, and there is a whole lot of extra machinery that you need to.
Shouldn't it be naturally cut off on both ends anyway, that integral? I mean, one is just the scale you have associated with the string, the other one is Hubble. I mean, I'm not sure that integral per se, I wouldn't say.
Oh, but what would cut it for the very small scales?
On small scales, eventually, surely it's a field theory. There's some scale that cuts it off. I mean, you don't integrate to infinity.
Well, I would agree with that, but this is not a model-independent statement, right? They are thinking of string theory strings, I don't know.
Well, not every quantity, I mean, I don't think necessarily you're going to probe the UV by doing this, but in principle, not every quantity you're calculating has to be insensitive to the UV physics.
Well, that's true. Well, but now I'm saying probably there is too much, there are too many orders of magnitude in L before you actually hit the width of the string, such that you will run into problems. And it's true that you will always get some sort of cutoff, whether it's just the thickness of the loop or the gravitational back reaction doesn't really matter. But you have to introduce that on top of this modeling, and you will end up with a huge population that peaks around that scale, right? Whereas here, the function is integrable. Nothing bad happens. Okay, so that's why I will stick to the one-scale modeling. Okay, so...
Before you move on to the equation, so this is d rho df.
Yes.
Yes, okay. And so the power there is power radiated per frequency for a string of length L, H, T. And why does it scale with A? Why is the argument scaled with A like that? And what is that P?
What is P?
Yeah, it's the power per frequency radiated by a loop of length L at time t, and what's
those factors? Wait, this is f. This is f, I think. So then you choose a frequency, and then you do the integral, and the power scales with L. This is also f. And this is t. And this is t. Yes.
So sorry, is that the argument of P, or is that something you're multiplying by P?
That's the argument of P.
And so it depends on product of frequency times the length over...
Well, yes, you peak the frequency, so, right, because this is a function...
Did you visualize the frequency today, or this is the physical frequency at the time, that's my
real... It's today, that's why there's...
It's today. Okay, and that's why the A's are there. Right.
Yes, that's why the A's are there, because you have to redshift the frequency.
Do you mean there's a two different arguments?
No.
No.
No, you multiply. Well, it will make the functional dependence of P more complicated, but yes, maybe let's not dig that deep. There isn't a whole lot we will learn from this.
No, but I think that this is just the physical frequency at the time. That's the Gomoian frequency over A.
Right.
Yes.
Okay.
It is. Okay. So moving on to what we actually wanted to do with this. And what we wanted to do was to not really improve the way you extract information, but instead try to say what we can learn about the early universe, provided that we have such a signal produced by a network of cosmic strings. So what we did... it's sort of on top of this, we introduced a modification of cosmology and wanted to see how the resulting signal would change because of that. So a very simple modification that you can write down easily is just saying that rho, maybe I should call it total, like I used to before, simply goes as, I will call this rho total, let's say standard model, for temperatures lower than a certain temperature. This will be our sort of key parameter in defining such a phenomenological modification. So for t smaller than t delta, we just extrapolate current data, and this is our expansion history. But once we hit t delta, we actually just match this such that rho is rho total of t delta, okay, just to match at this point, and then times a to power minus n. Right, so essentially the density goes as in standard cosmology up until you hit temperature t delta, and then we say a different contribution dominates the expansion, and it starts going as a to power minus n instead, and just matching at the point t delta. Okay, so this is the simple modification that we can do. I don't want to go into too much details again, but just if we wrote out this formula with all the proper redshift factors, it turns out that there is one thing analytically that we can check, and this is omega. That will measure at some very high frequency, so I will say f going to infinity. Just by expanding this and looking at the redshift factors, we can find the what power law we will find. And the result turns out to be quite simple. It's just f to power 8 minus 2n over 2 minus n, provided that n is bigger than 10 over 3. If n is smaller than 10 over 3, the power is just f to power minus 1. So this is how this would behave analytically for very high frequencies. So maybe let me show you what will actually happen. I will try to draw an example of a cosmic string spectrum. Okay, and this is of course the frequency, not the time. So typically a cosmic string spectrum would look something like this. Maybe I got this a bit wrong. Yes. This is your very typical cosmic string spectrum that you get in standard cosmological evolution. Now, if you look into this a bit, for instance, choosing the time over which you integrate, because this is just the time in which the network produced this signal, you will find that this, for instance, this bit is actually produced during current matter domination. Maybe I shouldn't write that down here, but what I'm trying to say is that this is the part of the signal produced most recently. Those wiggles come from the number of degrees of freedom changing already in radiation domination, and then you end up with a flat plateau when the number of degrees of freedom ceases to change. And what our formula tells us, well, first of all, if we use n equal to 4, which is radiation domination, you see that f is 0, so this is, we correctly predicted that this is Rd. So n equal to 4. But then if we change something, for instance, introduce an early period of matter domination, what will happen is instead this will change into f to power minus 1. So this would be early matter domination. And if we change the behavior of the total density such that there is a component that redshifts faster than radiation, for instance, one example here would be kination with n equal to 6, then we would see a power, well, this gives us f equal to 1 then. I mean, yes, f to power 1. So kination and equal to 6. Okay. I'm not sure if this is very convincing, but what I can tell you is that we did the numerical evaluation of this, of course, using the DeVos model. You can predict the loop number density also in a background that's redshifting slower and faster than radiation. And indeed, this is exactly what we see, that those power laws change according to this very simple equation.
Simple intuitive understanding why it's independent of n below 10 first?
It's independent of what?
N. You just wrote it's f to the minus 1 when n is less than 10 first.
Intuitive understanding. Well, so this is the lowest power you can get here. Essentially, because even if you cut the integral at some point, well, if you write this out properly, there will be a 1 over f factor, and it's just exemplifying that. So this this doesn't really depend on matter domination or anything. If you cut the integral altogether, you will still just see that power. Okay.
One simple question. I'm a bit surprised by the radiation domination behavior, because I guess you would expect that at some point it drops off, right? So high frequency. I mean, it cannot be indefinitely growing.
Yes. You mean that you need a cutoff. That is true.
You cannot see it. I'm wondering where that is drop, where it has to drop.
That's true. I mean, but that's, It does have to, you can't have indefinite kination, that's definitely true. You have to, it has to start somewhere, and then you would just see this probably fall off. Because typically the way to enter kination is only when inflation ends. So that would correspond to late period of inflation ending up in the field oscillating coherently somehow, which is kination, and then going back to normal evolution as the field redshifts away.
I would say maybe your natural cutoff would be the time scale or the energy scale at which you start the set of scaling of your network in this case.
Or yes, yes, that's the other possibility, that the string network is actually produced at some point. So that will also introduce a cutoff, even if kination was somehow indefinite. Okay.
Can you draw for comparison how it would look like with the other model?
No, we didn't check with the other model, but actually, so we didn't go through with the analysis for the other model. But with the other model, the spectrum looks completely differently, right? You have, it grows here because of this huge population of small loops. And in general, I can only tell you that I don't have a very good understanding of what would happen then. I'm sure something will, because this is just, this is mostly coming from the redshift, in fact. If you did the same, if you played the same game for the spectrum from inflation, you would actually see the same power loss, I think. At least for kination, it grows as f to power 1. Yes, Danny actually worked on that, I think.
That's well, for kination of the equation of a state equal 1, I mean, kination can be anything between 1/3 to 1. So in the power of the spectrum distortion, that is reflected.
Yes. OK. So of course, now the key thing for us here is at what frequency does the behavior change? And again, this is something that we can try and attack analytically, but in practice, the best way to do it is just to do the integral and see where the difference comes in. And I can show you, well, the result isn't very complicated. Essentially, f delta will just go as 10 to power minus 2 hertz. Then there's t delta, which is a parameter that I already introduced, over GeV. And then there is, of course, we need to separate this somehow. There's a dependence on all of the other parameters. So essentially, 0.1 over alpha, 50 over gamma, and most notably, 10 to minus 11 over G mu. Over G mu. Yes. Okay. So essentially what happens is that the frequency goes linearly with temperature, and as you see, if we set the temperature to about 1 GeV, we end up with 10 to minus 2 hertz for the frequency if G mu was 10 to minus 11. So let me complete the picture a bit. If G mu here was 10 to minus 11, which is, well, it's a value people typically quote because this is the upper bound that we currently have from PTA constraints. So there's the PTA is somewhere here. PTAs are somewhere here, and if you chose bigger value, you would just violate that constraint. But 10 to minus 2 is actually quite well within the reach of LISA, so let me try and maybe something like this, Lisa. So, in practice, this is observable for quite a range of temperatures. As you see, of course, this sadly becomes more difficult if G mu is smaller, because then the frequency also... did I get this right? Well, because then the whole signal essentially just moves this way, and the frequency becomes more difficult to detect. But maybe let me now show you a figure of what we can actually probe, or maybe not. Before I do this, I gave you this rather, well, you might think an intuitive model. There isn't really a reason why we would think this necessarily has to happen. But the point is that any modification of the expansion history will be imprinted on our cosmic string spectrum. For instance, a much simpler modification, and one that you probably expect, would be a change in the number of degrees of freedom. So if we play almost the same game with G star and say that G star is G star SM for, again, temperature smaller than T delta, but then we increase it by, well, some extra particles beyond SM give us plus delta G star. Again, this will have an impact on the spectrum. Now, the impact is, of course, less spectacular. Essentially, what happens is you produce a small dip, and then it keeps going with power, F to power 0, just as in radiation domination. And the value of the dip, again, using a very similar method to here, can be estimated, and the gravitational wave amplitude for, again, F going to infinity would eventually go to omega gravitational waves at T delta. And then G star over G star plus delta G. And this is SM. SM, the power being 1 over 3. These two. And these are the two different cases. So this step would not be huge, but if you look at this, essentially if delta, let's say our accuracy with which we can measure what delta omega is, would be, say, 1%, that would correspond to about 2 new degrees of freedom, looking at this expression. Delta G equal to 2. So we can actually, if we measure the spectrum with an accuracy of, say, 1%, we can actually put a very decent bound on the number of degrees of freedom that we have at that time. Okay, and now something which is far too difficult for me to draw, which is the reach of all those experiments. So this is the final most interesting plot that we can produce with this. Oh, time flies. Okay. So essentially this is the parameter space that we can gauge with T star, as you see, conveniently starting at 5 MeV, because this is already constrained by nuclear synthesis constraints. This is corresponding at delta. And those various contours show you what values of G mu we can probe. And this essentially just comes from checking whether our point of departure is in the sensitivity of a given experiment. So if the curve grows and hits a different experiment, this doesn't show it. But this is, of course, dependent on the value of N you choose. Well, this is not. This only depends on the value of G mu and the F delta frequency. Okay, so as you see, for 1 GeV, we end up nicely in the LISA sensitivity curve, as we thought we would. Edge and ion, which here is called the Earth version, is nicely between LISA and ET, and then ET, which as you see can probe all the way to 10 to power 4 GeV. So a pretty good reach in temperatures. Okay, we have anything more? Yes, but that will come later. Okay, so now, maybe rather quickly, let's say in minutes, something quite different. Essentially trying to use the very extreme version of this setup. Thank you.
Actually, before you go on, it seems like LIGO would already have something to say about a combination of gene you knew and kination.
It could, yes. Oh yeah, I didn't put it in the figure. But this is just my omission. No, okay. Because the figure only shows this point.
Right, but if it's going up from there, LIGO will...
But if it's going up, that is true. So in the paper, we have plots that very nicely show for what, for a given GMU, what range of T delta you could actually probe with LIGO if there was a period of kination. Because it's true that if it goes up, the prospects for detection improve quite a bit.
I imagine there's got to be kind of an excluded region in the parameter space of G mu and T delta for kination that's already ruled out by LIGO.
Yes, that's true. But then the slight problem is that you need to always define the cutoff then. So you sort of have an extra parameter. Because in practice, if you don't do it, you're always excluded by BBN constraint, right? Because there is at some 10 to minus 6 or so.
You're integrated too much, right, okay.
There is a BBN constraint, so you would just...
But that cutoff has to be necessarily related to your tension, you know, because the tension comes from the energy scale at which you produce in first place the cosmic strain. So there's an interplay there. It's not that you can go all the way up to arbitrary temperatures.
Yes, that's true.
There's a cutoff naturally emerging because there is a moment in which you trigger phase transition or whatever phenomena that produces these guys, and they go into scaling, and only in that moment you apply this formalism.
That's true, yes. So there is a cutoff, but it's not immediately clear.
Well, that's the problem, because it's very far. You will put constraint from NF, which will, as is immediately guessing, reducing the parameter space.
Right.
It should.
So does LIGO give you any information that BBN doesn't already give you?
That, yes. Well, it could, because it just has better sensitivity, right? If BBN was here, then LIGO is here, and it could.
Okay, I'd love to see the plot of G mu versus T delta, what's ruled out by BBN, what's ruled out by LIGO for kination size.
Right.
So that question you asked, I don't know the answer here, but in the context of how you distort the inflationary background, actually, the answer is LIGO does not add anything, because you cut off to BBN slash CMB NF contribution, because you already rule out the parameter space that LIGO could probe.
Right.
Here might be different, though, but in that case, it doesn't.
Yes, that's true. So here you will gain something. There are, as you see, depending on where you put the cutoff, you can probe something with LIGO that's not excluded by BBN yet. But it's not a huge part of the parameter space, I would say. Right? Because it's, the interval in F delta or T delta that you'll be probing is just essentially how wide the LIGO band is. Okay, so now on to something a bit different, or you would say that the extreme version of this story of modifying cosmology, except we don't have to modify anything in the... where should I start? Except we don't need to modify anything, because now we'll be thinking about inflation, the actual primordial inflation. Okay, maybe I won't need this. Hopefully I won't need this. Yes, we'll be thinking about the primordial inflation. Okay, so the story is that what if the cosmic string network was produced before or during inflation? That's the question. And of course, what would happen, you can sort of see from this story, is that of course, if the background starts inflating, we don't need this anymore. The density will just go as a to minus 2, because no loops are produced. The whole network will just be diluted by the expansion. And same as curvature, you can see that essentially the length scale associated with our network, which is that the correlation length of the network, let's call it L, will just then go as A. Will just be diluted by the expansion. Given that rho infinite goes as 1 over L squared, what will happen then, of course, is that if we plot the density, let's say we start here, this is rho infinite, and this is the beginning of inflation, so A initial, it will of course go down, but it will stop going down at and when inflation ends, and then it will actually start regrowing to eventually reach scale. Now the question is whether that can happen before today, right? A0 will be somewhere here, but given that this is effectively just a length scale, so if we're thinking about the minimal amount of e-folds of inflation that we need, if this happened very shortly after the beginning of inflation, the scale should be coming back into our horizon right about now. So the way...
How many strings do we expect to have in our universe? If we have strings, then we have inflation, then we maybe only have one string at most in our entire universe.
Yes, that's true. Well, but this is actually, this is more generically true. In a scaling solution, typically you have of order of a few of those long strings per horizon.
It's a related question. So previously when we were discussing it, it's not directly connected to your plot, but all those loops that you had said were hanging around, in the models that you discussed, they're evaporating, they're going away?
Yes.
They're going away.
Yes, yes. They just radiate and go into gravitational waves. Right. Yes, so if we think about this story, the question is, when would the network go back into scaling? Or, to be more precise, a much better measure of this is when L would be equal to the horizon size. So LH equal to 1. And this is a much better measure because... So in Voss modeling, we will see that when the network re-enters the horizon, this extra way of losing energy will kick in, and the network will slowly evolve into its scaling solution. But the question of whether a network is scaling already or not is quite irrelevant, because the point is that we only need n in practice from the evolution itself.
Omega infinity there instead of delta infinity?
Because
it was...
This is rho.
But you said that the scaling solution is that rho over rho total goes constant, not that rho
goes
constant.
Oh, good point. Yes, this is...
Thank you.
Rho total.
That makes a lot
well spotted, yes. It made little sense. It would be a weird power.
I was trying to figure out how rho infinity could grow, but okay, thank you.
Okay. How rho infinity can grow?
Rho infinity over rho total, that makes perfect sense how that can grow. But how rho infinity could grow was confusing.
Okay, for a good reason. Okay, so a much better way of trying to define when something interesting could happen is when our correlation length would re-enter the horizon, because that's essentially when we start producing loops. So let's define this moment as z equal to some z tilde. And again, for notation reasons, people, when doing this calculation, like to use redshift instead of A, but of course, it's almost the same thing. The convention doesn't really matter. So the question now would be, how much inflation do we need? And can strings actually grow back if we have, well, just about enough inflation? And to try and answer this, maybe I can get rid of this. We won't need this anymore. We will sadly need this because there is a different method of computing the spectrum. Okay, but going back to how much inflation do we need, essentially the thing to look at is the curvature constraint. This is typically the strongest constraint on the amount of e-folds that you need. And the nice thing about it here is that we don't really need to know the amount of e-folds we need, because this thing evolves in the same way as the curvature radius does, right? It's just stretched by the expansion.
Say that again, the number of e-folds we need, please.
So we don't need to compute the number of e-folds that we need, right? Because the curvature, which is the source of our constraint, goes the same as our correlation length. Right, so we would be, it's I would say n total equals to n total plus something. Okay, the only thing that we need to modify what you would do now is to calculate how many e-folds of inflation we need. What I'm saying is that I don't really need to do that because this goes the same as curvature, so I will just need to find the difference, and the difference is essentially coming from the fact that the constraint on curvature is stronger, right? So the curvature radius is bigger than our horizon. It's not equal to the horizon. If it was, delta n would actually be zero, and the two would re-enter the horizon at the exact same moment. But the bound on the curvature is that omega minus 1 is 0.007 plus 0.0037. I will add plus 1 sigma because it makes for a more optimistic conclusion. But essentially, the only thing we need to change in the constraint is to it's made more severe by the fact that typically when calculating the amount of e-folds you need, you include that number, right? You have half a log of omega minus 1, which is increasing the number of e-folds. So, yes. So delta n, the time, let's say inflation actually started here, ai. And we started at delta n e-folds after the inflation has started. Okay, then delta n would just be a log of half of this, so 1 half log omega minus 1, which is 2.7, roughly. So if our cosmic string scale exits the horizon 2.7 e-folds after the inflation started, it would just grow back into the horizon today. This is what we get. Now, it turns out that this is not a very, this is not necessarily enough, because if the string network would just re-enter today, we would just maybe produce one loop today. So it needs to re-enter a bit earlier on. That's why we will, so we need to modify this equation slightly, essentially by adding a modification and requiring our cosmic string network to return be below the horizon at z tilde. So this is just essentially modifying the total omega that we have. So this would give us a plus 1/2, a logarithm, and then the density at z tilde. So omega lambda 1 plus z tilde squared plus omega m. Minus 1 plus z tilde to power 1 plus, of course, omega radiation 1 plus z tilde squared. Okay, with this, we have the number of e-folds that we need for the string network to re-enter the horizon at z tilde and begin production of loops again at that time.
I'm confused by the setup, because since there are very tight constraints on curvature of the universe,
yes,
and at the level of the background, the presence of this very super hot isonscale network of strings mimic the presence of curvature at the background.
Yes.
How can you have them contributing more power at the tens of omega than the actual upper bound on curvature.
Oh, that's why we need delta n for, right? We don't start with a network exactly at the beginning of inflation. It has to be produced delta n e folds later.
So, but this is my question precisely. So this means that during the evolution after inflation, there would be this term from this super horizon network that would mimic like having more curvature than we can tolerate from observation. If you make them enter before horizon size today, this means that their relative contribution to the energy budget in terms of an omega parameter is larger than the upper bound you have in curvature. Or am I misunderstanding something?
Is it? Does it mean? But you're thinking about the energy density,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I'm thinking at the level of the background, yeah, only level of the background.
So that I'm sure of, that the energy density, it just grows back, and at most is what you would get in scaling for that network.
Yeah, there isn't more. The fact that happens is because in terms of energy density, it evolves as 1 over a squared.
Yes.
It's the same as curvature. So.
Oh, yes, but it's cut when it reaches scaling, right? So it doesn't overgrow and cause problems at T0.
That could be, I don't know, but that's what I'm asking.
Yeah, so I think what you're thinking of is, it's true that if this re-enters before, let's say A0 is here, A0. So if the network did that, there would be more of it than there is, yes, than there is curvature. And it would cause problems, but it will stop because we start producing loops. And because the energy doesn't increase anymore, instead we produce a gravitational wave background.
So how much earlier compared to today you make them re-enter?
Z tilde. They re-enter the horizon at Z tilde.
Which is free parameter for you?
It's for now a free parameter. I'll show you some values, but it's typically 1,000 or more. So it's actually they re-enter.
That's very dangerous, isn't it?
It sounds very dangerous.
It's like when you're making a CMD.
How is it more dangerous than just having a cosmic string network all along?
In the sense that they are contribution to the expansion history, you know. So because there is that term, which has a relative weight in the cosmic history.
Yes, but it's suppressed to the case where they were in scaling all the time.
No, but the point is when you're producing a phase transition after inflation, okay, they are in scaling all the time, which means they are a insignificant fraction of the energy of the background all the time. But that's not the case here, right?
It is. Well, this is rho infinite over rho total. It's never more than in scaling. There's actually less of them, almost all the time, except very recently, hopefully.
What's the constraint on omega k right now?
What's
the constraint on like the curvature?
Well, if you wrote omega there, k.
It's this. And this gives you the 2.7.
Can you put this log of beta better, like the number of long strings per horizon?
Yes, yes. I'll get to that. I'll get to that. So this is not the whole story because what I told you, yes, is essentially that if the network is produced delta n e folds after the inflation begins, this curve essentially, let's draw it back to the way it was. AI, if we introduce delta n, essentially this whole curve just moves a bit. But there is a different game we can play, because the string network can also be produced in a first order transition, which would mean that the typical density initially would be larger. Essentially because, well, if we assume that the network is in scaling, then L is roughly proportional to 1 over h. So you get of order of 1 string per horizon. This would be our initial value if the network was actually scaling also before inflation. But if the network was actually just produced here through a first order phase transition, the value can be very different. I will parameterize it by, let's call it xi. And the reason for it is, of course, that then the relevant scale is not the whole Hubble anymore, it's the size of the bubbles, essentially. So in practice, for all those phase transition experts out there, what would change is this parameter would essentially be, okay, so this is, I think, RH over the horizon, where this is the size of the bubbles in a first order transition. Or to put it even more simply, psi will be just proportional to beta over H. Beta over H is the typical parameter that people quote for a first order phase transition. And in fact, if you remember, it can actually be quite big. Did I get this wrong? I want the density larger, so L smaller. Okay, no, should be okay. So, yes, maybe this equation isn't that helpful, but what I'm saying is that if we just produce the network in a first order phase transition, the relevant scale will not be the whole Hubble size, it will just be the size of the bubbles of the transition. There are many bubbles in one Hubble size, which means that the initial density could actually be a lot larger. And then the story would also work because the curve would move upwards and we would reach scaling a bit earlier also. And essentially that corresponds to adding this number here.
Sorry, Mark, just to understand. So you are assuming there is a phase transition just slightly before onset of inflation so that the phase transition creates cosmic strings, but they yes. don't have time to reach a scaling before the onset of inflation.
Exactly. I mean, actually, so this is a good way to put it. It's just a sum because it can also happen during inflation, and you will also start with bigger density and slightly less e-folds to dilute the network. Okay, but if the transition is second order, then you just get delta M. Yes.
And isn't more acute the problem I was asking about in that case?
In what way?
In the sense that now you have a bigger energy density stored in these guys?
No. Again, I mean, okay, maybe. Well, today you don't. Today it will always stop at the scaling value, right? Because you will start producing loops. That's what regulates it, so it's safe. In the late evolution, we're always safe because of this extra channel, is what I think. Okay, so knowing all this, we can try and see, okay, maybe, should I show you a plot? Maybe I'll show you the plot later on, because we have this delta z, z tilde plotted, and you would see how many e-folds less we need, and it will turn out not to be crazy, but I will show that later on. First, let's talk about the signals yet again. And here, sadly, we'll have to switch to the other method of computing the spectrum that I think Danny talked about last week also. Maybe I'll put it here. So the other method that I described in the bit that is now gone and beneath this figure, as you remember, the other method was to just assume there is a fixed number of features on a loop that keep producing gravitational waves.
Because we're now running close to an hour and a half.
Ooh.
We want to try and wrap things up.
Yeah, okay. I don't really need to tell you how to calculate this. The only thing I will tell you is that gravitational wave spectrum will be proportional in this other method. Essentially, again, you keep integrating over the history, so dz, dl, and you have a rate. Dr over dl dz, and then you have the waveform appropriate for your Casper kink. Okay, this is the method of calculating, but it allows you to find the rate. And the whole point here is that when you can calculate the rate, you can exclude rare events that were produced most recently. Because the rate typically grows as you go back in time, but we can define f, which is an integral of, again, dz, dh, and this d2r, well, the rate that we can compute, dz, dh, and cut it at a z star exactly such that this is equal to f. So we cut our contribution into two bits, the earlier bit from before z star, when the rate is too large, it's larger than the frequency, contributes to the stochastic background. The other contribution simply goes into the rate of individual bursts that we would see at a given frequency. And I can just show you the results that we get for both of those things. Yes. Okay, so first, this is the change in the number of e-folds. So this delta n plus logarithm of xi. As you see, what we need to re-enter around 10 to z 10 to power 4 is, say, 6. So 6 e-folds less, or a million bubbles per horizon. And then this is how the results look like. So there are two curves which are non-diluted. As you see, we're choosing g mu, which would be excluded already by PTA constraints. But this is fine, because if we dilute the network, and it only re-enters scaling, it only re-enters the horizon in this example at, say, 9 times 10 to power 3 redshift, as you see, the stochastic background is cut, such that we don't violate the constraint anymore, and we're fine. But if you look at the rate that we get, because, well, now most of the signal is actually those rare bursts produced most recently, because the network just grew back, that would correspond to 10 to minus 8. So that would be no dilution, all those continuous curves. Those are just rates calculated for all the experiments. And the other one is this dotted one, which is, as you see here, there is less of them, but it's still above 1. So we could actually see bursts at LISA from a stochastic, from a background of cosmic strings that was produced before inflation, even though it's not excluded by the typical stochastic background constraint. And again, of course, the same gain of g mu 10 to minus 10 for a slightly different redshift of reentry. As you see, we also get a rate which is non-zero in all of the experiments, even though SKA will only see it after a couple of years of operation. And to close up, this is the whole parameter space that you can have in this problem. Continuous lines, oh, in terms of g mu, of course, for the network, and z tilde. So this is the most diluted to the least diluted. Continuous lines are stochastic backgrounds. Dashed lines are the rates. I mean, when we will see bursts, so at least one burst in a given experiment per year. And as you see, those constraints win for non-diluted networks. But actually, if we keep diluting in this part of the parameter space when the strings re-enter around 10 to 4, 5, redshift, we will see bursts, but not the stochastic backgrounds. And of course, SKA, this is the 20-year estimate, so actually we have a good chance of seeing the bursts before SKA actually starts excluding this part of the parameter space. Okay, and not to keep you any longer, that's all I had for you today.
Just very briefly, how long does a burst last for?
I'm not exactly sure. It's rather brief, but it's I don't have a time scale in mind. Do you know yet?
I think it's exactly by the ovulation time. Oh, sorry, exactly by the low frequency, range that the experiment can go.
Ah, okay, but that would mean it's sort of instantaneous, and you're just thinking whether you can detect it or not. Wouldn't it? So.
Yeah, I think it has something like a Fourier transform, and then I think in the time domain it's like 1 over the minimum frequency that it's
running. Okay, so that means that they last for a very short time, I think.
Yeah, I think that's the first.
Right, that's
a lot more discussion next week.
Well, I hope so. Any more questions?
Discussion later on.
Okay.